Now to questions of how we emerge as a country from the times that we've been living through. And we heard this stark warning from the World Health Organization in May. Their report into COVID-19's effects noted that the mental health and well-being of whole societies have been severely affected by this crisis and are a priority to be addressed urgently. Now, here in Australia, those words have found an echo among health workers who are seeing the cumulative effect of disruption, economic uncertainty, confinement, and social isolation. Even before the pandemic, our mental health system was criticised as too fragmented, too under-resourced to work properly. And over the last few months, it's been stretched by the twin crises of drought and fires. So are we ready for what some fear could be the pandemic's real second wave? The fears, anxieties and related problems caused by the virus. Christine Morgan is Chief Executive of the National Mental Health Commission. She's led the team formulating a National Mental Health and Wellbeing Pandemic Response Plan. And she joins me from Canberra. In Sydney, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Scott. She's Medical Director of the Young Adult Mental Health Unit at St. Vincent's Hospital. A warm welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Christine Morgan, a report card first, please, on Australia's mental health right now. Could you just give us a snapshot of how people are faring as we consider, a pretty uncertain future, I suppose?
Look, I think that is absolutely the case. I think that we continue to see elevated levels of anxiety, and it's complex anxiety. It is anxiety which is responsive to the changing circumstances. So at the beginning of the COVID-19, that anxiety was predominantly, we heard back around things such as our physical health and safety. We now have complex anxiety as we seek to lower some of the restrictions and what that means for people and their fears. We see elevated evidence of clinically significant depressive symptoms that has come out recently. We certainly see more complex psychological mental distress. And we're also seeing, most concerningly, increased levels of anger and potentially some aggression as well. So we're not coming out of it in a great shape. We certainly have things there that we are addressing, I would have to agree that the mental health issues are of real concern. And the other thing we need to be very concerned about, I think, is that those with complex mental illnesses that went into the pandemic not well, we know that their illnesses in many instances have been exacerbated. So we have a lot that we need to look at.
So you're already seeing this, even at this pretty early stage of the emergence?
We've been seeing it really from get-go, Geraldine. We've been keeping a close eye on those people who are accessing the Beyond Blue coronavirus line, the helplines, Lifeline, Kids Helpline, Beyond Blue, as I say. Across our services, we've been touching base at a Commonwealth level with each of the state and territory jurisdictions to see what's happening in those states. And yes, we're certainly seeing it. We're also seeing increased rates of suicide ideation. So people actually translating those fears and those feelings into quite significant conversations. So yes, there are concerns that we've been identifying from get-go. They're certainly not dissipating. We still need to address them, so there's still a long road ahead.
So, again, we're seeing the role, are we, of chronic stress. Is that it? A perception of people that they're never... They just can't see broad sunny uplands emerging anytime soon. So that just exacerbates pre-existing conditions.
That's a good way to put it. I think we're seeing sort of something which is, as in all of our life, is quite a dynamic process. So right at the very beginning, when we all went very quickly into working from home, we had two, if you like, environmental things emerging. We had the stresses that came from being 24/7 in a home environment, the impact of that on relationships, the impact on parents of trying to cope with supervising online schooling, and all of those issues, coupled with the fact that back then in really around March, we looked at what was happening overseas, we saw very high death rates, and we had no idea how long it was going to go for. So our life was completely changed. But the other really concerning thing that started to emerge then was the impact of real loneliness for those Australians in particular who live on their own. and the fact that they were facing a future where they didn't know when they could even give their loved ones a hug. You know, they had no idea. So we saw the impacts of loneliness emerging, and we know that that is an increased risk factor for depression. What we're seeing now as the restrictions are starting to be eased is ongoing anxiety, but that anxiety is now becoming, is this safe? Can I go back out into life? Is there going to be a second wave? And so the anxiety is there. And of course, it's coupled with the economic impact of COVID-19. And that is a very, very real pressure factor for so many Australians. So there's a lot of things happening that are causing that ongoing distress and anxiety.
Elizabeth Scott, do you want to comment on what you're seeing in your role?
Absolutely. And I'd certainly agree. I mean, it's very clear that we've dodged a bullet in terms of the health crisis with COVID in Australia at the moment. But the real crisis is in mental health. And I comment from two levels. From a personal point of view, as a director of a unit where we see young people with very complex disorders, we have been overwhelmed with the demand for that unit. We have a long waiting list, and my nursing unit manager contacts me on a daily basis to try and manage that and triage that. The same is true for our community clinics, for our multidisciplinary care in the community. And unfortunately, we've come to the sad state, as in, I think, ICU clinicians in other countries, of having to turn people away from care. And that is incredibly distressing for young people and their families who've often come on long journeys to get to our service, and we are having to turn them away. So I think that's from the situation
and
on the ground.
And this is more than usual, is it? This is pandemic related. That's what I'm seeking to isolate with you. You'd be doing this more than you would on a normal basis, because we don't have enough. But that's the general consensus, even in normal times, do we?
No. So it's very clear from the reports, which is about to be launched from the Productivity Commission and from the Royal Commission in Victoria, that we were already dealing with systems, mental health systems in crisis. We already had mental health services that were chaotic, fragmented, that were not fit for purpose. And I think the WHO has kind of outlined in its report that this is a global problem. It's not just an Australian problem, and that we have the opportunity with COVID to actually build a mental health service that is fit for purpose and fit for the future. So that is our opportunity. But we were already dealing with a system that was overwhelmed. So we're now dealing, we've done a pretty good job of transforming to telehealth, to keep in contact with patients, because a lot of people obviously have not been able to come forward for care. That's been very true of people with chronic mental health conditions, many of whom relied on support in the community, which disappeared. So my psychiatry colleague was actually taking medications and food at times out to people in the community who could not access basic care over the time of social isolation. And we're now seeing an escalation in new presentations for care. So I think we're going to,
Well, I'd like to get some specifics if possible. Are there certain areas, Christine, that are particularly prone? Is it more in the regions than in the urban areas, outer urban, inner urban? How would you think about it?
Well, I don't think we actually can sort of say that this is having more of an impact on one group than another. I think, just picking up on what Liz is saying, I think that virtually the starting point here is that it impacts on all Australians when you've had the significant disruptive factors we've had. And I think it's really clear where you're looking at this. And I think it's right, Geraldine, that we're looking at this from the specific response to the pandemic and COVID-19. That has had an impact on all. But I think, and I'm picking up on the point Liz is making, that everyone went into the pandemic with a level of mental health or mental illness. And what the pandemic is doing is exacerbating that. You put that into a scenario where it was extraordinarily difficult for people to make contact. And that, I think, is one of the concerns. One of the statistics that I just read yesterday that really concerns me, and it comes out of a study at Melbourne University, is that of those people with really significant levels of mental distress, so high mental distress, 42% of them are actually choosing not to access help for some reason, whereas for those with mild mental health and distress, only 8% of those are not choosing to seek help. So there's something really happening there in terms of people being significantly impacted and yet still not accessing services.
So what do you think that is?
Look, I think it's probably a couple of things. I think, as Liz has said, capacity is certainly an issue. I worry that for some it might be financial concerns, that they feel they can't afford to get care, and I think that is an issue we do need to look at. I think it is one of the inherent issues with our psychological distress is that we kind of feel like we should be able to just keep going on, and we can't. So I think one of the most critical things that we were looking at doing with our pandemic mental health and wellbeing response plan was to actually acknowledge that we need to really look at trying to identify those people in need. We need really good data. Really importantly, we actually have to not wait for people to come to us. We need to look at how we can flex up our system in response to COVID-19 to try and get out to people, to make that more assertive outreach, to get out into communities and have access points where they can get to us.
Yes.
And then we've got to link those services together.
But like, it's interesting here. You look at the study by UNICEF Australia, looked specifically at how the virus was, an associated lockdown was affecting teenagers. And that seemed to be quite an issue. I think that also emerged from the YouGov survey recently, that actually there was quite a generational divide in this experience, that older people were feeling more settled, I think is probably the word, and younger people were really quite riddled with anxieties. So is this something, Liz Scott, that's particularly your area? I just wonder if you're seeing something slightly augmented as a result of this pandemic.
Yeah, so if you look at evidence from previous situations like the global financial crisis, for instance, it is predominantly young people who were affected by that because of declining employment, declining in job, you know, vocational opportunities. And what you saw out of the 2008 financial crisis, and this is very well documented across the world, are increased rates in mental health presentations, self-harm, drug and alcohol use, and suicides. And that predominantly affected young people. And that, so there was a 20 to 30% increase in suicide rates in many of the countries that were most affected by the global financial crisis. And if you think about it, we're now looking at unemployment figures. We were looking at, you know, COVID infection rates. Now the daily issue is, what are the unemployment figures? And youth unemployment has increased at a much higher rate. So if you look at the job losses, about 830,000 job losses, I think, were reported this week, predominantly in women and young people. So young people who are at the start of their lives trying to maintain education and employment, if they fall off the ladder now, then we know that for some young people it will be really very difficult for them to get back onto that ladder again.
Yeah, well, that's why recessions, you know, I remember hearing The Economist recently, you know, on Radio National just saying recessions to be avoided at all costs, because that's the tragedy. People losing their jobs, they don't get back in easily, but often we're talking about people who haven't even got in, which is even more acute. Let me just tell listeners, Elizabeth Scott and Christine Morgan are my guests. Liz Scott is Director of the Young Adult Mental Health Unit at St Vincent's Hospital, and Christine Morgan is CEO of the National Mental Health Commission, and we're talking about the mental health challenges that are going to confront us as we emerge from the pandemic. Now, I mean, for instance, here's a specific measurement. Lifeline was hit by a 25% increase in calls in March, bringing the national total to around 90,000 calls, the highest in the organisation's 56-year history. So, you know, that is pretty specific, Christine, isn't it? For people who are listening, so that we don't just sort of slit our throats when we say this, you know, Lifeline exists, like, are we reaching, how do we reach out to those people so that they do feel more supported? Because you also reported an increase in social trust at certain levels amongst the community as a result of the coronavirus.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Look, I think one of the most significant things that has emerged out of COVID-19, and we have to look for some of those learnings that we can take forward, is that we had already had in place things such as Lifeline, Kids Helpline, Beyond Blue, a raft of what we call digital helpline, support line, entry points for people. And when we say entry points, we mean that you can pick up a phone, go online and connect with somebody and start that conversation, which is a critical first step in addressing any mental health issues. And what we have seen across the board has been not only an amped up investment from the government, recognising that these services are really critical. But yes, we have been tracking on a weekly, monthly basis with each of those services what has been happening. And we saw significant peaks, particularly in April, interestingly, right across all of the services for people reaching out to have a chat. What was really important that we found was to actually have an encouragement of people to do that for whatever they were feeling about COVID-19 and not necessarily labelling it mental illness. I think there's unfortunately still quite a stigma in Australia for reaching out for help. So we tried to say, get the message out there to people that it's actually kind of to be expected that you are going to be feeling odd. We tried to get out some education of things to look for in themselves, so changes in mood, escalated levels of anger perhaps, withdrawal, anything, not sleeping, headaches, loss of appetite, you know, those classic kind of signs, and would say, reach out. And I think that was one of the positive things, that we did actually see people reaching out and connecting with those services. We also saw a fairly rapid take up in telehealth services. And that was really the most significant shift, I think, where people could access mental health services through telehealth. And we saw through to April, May, probably about 50% of people accessing mental health services were doing it through telehealth services. So they were good. The bits that were really starting to concern us when we started looking at putting the plan in place was the fact of those people who were disconnecting from the services, who we couldn't see. As Liz had said, those people out there in the community that people had to visit and reach out to. And that was a critical shift for us. So, yep, absolutely.
So they're the ones who really raised the flag. Yes, I can imagine. Liz Scott, are you doing telehealth services now yourself?
Yes, we are absolutely we had a rapid transition to telehealth, which would have taken years if we had to negotiate that. We have done it rapidly. So I think I've picking up on what Christine is saying, what we really have not had is an effective service structure. We have not had the places for people to go to, the integrated care, the multidisciplinary care that people need in the community. And the modelling that's been done by the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney has made it really clear what regions, what areas have the greatest need. We just come back from the north coast of New South Wales, where the suicide rate was 40% above the national average already. So there are some regions of Australia that are really going to be particularly affected by this. And we need to have the same type of system data modelling that we've seen with COVID to actually look at those places where there is great need and actually put services in place. And they need to be...
And we don't have that yet?
We do not have that yet. And there's an agreement about what those services should look like. So this is not, you know, we know that we need more specialist care in the community. We know that we need more aftercare for people presenting with suicide and self-harm. We know that we need more personalised, technology-enhanced care, which allows care coordination and care delivery. We know that we need more measurement-based care so we can treat, track, trace, so that we can actually find the people who are most at risk and make sure they're getting care. And we need to have that, you know, properly integrated with employment, housing, and all the social, you know, the community organisations that can provide the support that people need. So it's absolutely clear what the priorities are.
Can I ask you both a question I often think is not asked? What can local governments do here? Like, you know, the quality of the local surrounding community might just keep some of those people who rang Lifeline just under control in their own, as they see it themselves, if you know what I mean, not coming to the more acute and worrying level. Have you got any thoughts on that, Christine Morgan?
I think that's an excellent question, and the answer is yes. I think one of the things that we have been looking at as we have looked at what changes, as Liz has said, that we need to do to the system and how can we use the COVID-19 agreement by all the jurisdictions to come together to try to improve the system as an acceleration, as a momentum, if you like, to get those changes through. We're looking at all levels of government, so we're looking at Commonwealth government, we're looking at state governments, but really importantly, and we hear this consistently from people, is it is in our local communities that we can establish some of those supports and those structures and those access points. We can look after our own people if we get the right supports. And just earlier this week, I was talking to a number of mayors from local councils, and they are fully on board with saying, what can we do in terms of providing? And they may not be able to, of course, provide the clinical services, but the really important things that we need is, in addition to those fantastic services provided by Liz and others in extremely difficult circumstances where we have challenges to the system.
I was even thinking just of a climate of hope, if you know what I mean, as opposed to no hope, and, or, you know, everything's wrecked, as it were, and trying to sort of just encourage that sense that this too will pass.
I think that is incredibly important. I think the important positive messages that we have to give whilst recognising the incredible stresses that people are under is that sense of connectedness. It's interesting. I think that one of the most significant things that is emerging as a protective factor is staying connected with each other. We saw that out of the bushfires. What it translated to with the bushfires was coming together as communities. We haven't been able to do that physically, but that sense of connectedness, that sense, particularly with our young people, of giving them a sense of hope that it is, that there is a way through.
Which is where I think even, you know, dare I say, things like the ABC play a crucial role. Liz, I just want to read you quickly, because I asked listeners a few weeks back if they'd let us know if where they felt they were not thriving. I put it like that. And we had one from a woman, I won't mention her name, from Perth. I struggled early on in the pandemic, not being able to do my usual activities. I was teary for no particular reason and felt quite bereft. I read somewhere that introverts often cope less well in isolation due to the fact we have limited contacts and we need them regularly to affirm and appreciate us. Extroverts apparently don't care so much for who's affirming them. I found support from my GROW group, the mental health organisation that's Australia-wide and running e-groups at the moment. They're free, confidential, and no referral required. They may help others out there. Is that the sort of, would you like more of that, Liz Scott?
Absolutely. So, and I completely agree with Christine. What is required is hope and care and a lack of complacency. And a lot of the solutions need to be place-based. They need to be placed in our community and to make sure that people remain connected. So I think GROW is a really good example of that. I think we have there are other examples on the north coast of New South Wales, the south coast, who have had significant issues, as you say, with bushfires, drought, storms, flooding, and now with COVID, where local communities have come together to actually look to see what they can do and how they can help the most marginalised people in the community, including those who are, you know, already lonely. And I think we really need to support those initiatives. And those kind of community connectedness is incredibly important.
So one message from both of you about, for all of us listening to this, as well as the systems approach, what about the individual approach? Liz first.
So in terms of individuals, I think staying connected is incredibly important. Staying connected, staying active, seeking help if you need it. And as you know, there are, you know, support lines, but also making sure that if things are getting difficult, if it's really hard for you to have the energy to see people, if it's hard to stay in communication with family, if you really feel that you're struggling with daily life, to make sure that you get the care that you need. Right. And that we need to be really mindful as a community that this, for many people, is an urgent situation. We can't wait for 6 months or 2 years down the track to find that people have really fallen out of participation in the community. We need to act now.
And Christine Morgan, quickly from you.
Yep, just to add to that, so I would fully endorse everything Liz has said, and I'd add the point that our mental health is as much a part of us as our physical health. It is absolutely normal to at times not feel okay. So please understand that that is a really critical part of us. Stay connected, look out for each other. And if you know somebody who's finding it hard to reach out for help, encourage them to do so. We're all in this together.
I'm just very quickly, I've just a listener saying, why not talk about resilience? I can turn off the radio when it's a constant focus on the negative view of mental health. you know, because the ABC's got this big your mental health on July the 5th to the 11th to raise awareness about all these issues. I suppose it's important to also see what works, isn't it? Very quickly, Christine.
Totally. And I think that is, as I say, one of the learnings coming out of this. I sometimes resist using the word resilience because I think it's been battered around so much, but it is truly is. Mm-hmm. I think we, Aussies have an amazing capacity to come together and to get through. Mm. And we don't want to lose the lessons we can learn from this to say what has actually helped people to get through, what has been positive for them, and how can we use that and build that into the system going forward so that we can truly learn from it.
Yes, look, it's tricky, isn't it, this? Thank you both very much indeed for wrestling with that. Christine Morgan from the National Mental Health Commission and Elizabeth Scott, Medical Director of the Young Adult Mental Health Unit at St Vincent's Hospital. Thank you both.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
And I must say, you know, just to pick up on that, if this raises any issues for you, please do call Lifeline on 13114. 13114.